Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons, all, to episode 14 of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. So last time we were looking at diplomacy, surprise, surprise, between the years 1716 to 1720, as we were hovering around the year 1716 in particular to see how Peter the Great of Russia planned to mobilize the diplomatic and military support of the anti-Swedish League because he wanted one last push against Charles XII's Sweden. As it happened, Danish preoccupation and procrastination prevented the Armada from setting sail, but this decision only fanned the flames of Allied discord. Just as Sweden seemed to be on the ropes, the Allies seemed about to launch themselves into bitter infighting and dangerous competition. Through such developments, a Swedish resurgence, taking advantage of those divisions, would be possible. At least, this is what the Swedish king hoped. Charles XII had found a diplomatist capable of conducting such an opportunistic campaign. Sweden's future would be fought for in the conferences and courts of Europe rather than at the battlefield. With a bit of luck, the German nobleman, Baron Georg Heinrich von Goertz, believed he could reverse the current state of affairs, which seemed to have the Swedes trapped. All that he had to do was play to those same petty jealousies and suspicions which threatened to rip the entire anti-Swedish League apart. Since our coverage brings us tantalizingly close to the silent Sejm of 1717, I should warn you before we begin here, we won't be dealing with that pivotal event in Polish history for a few more episodes. Instead, what we're going to do here is look at the diplomacy and the intrigue of the era, essentially up to the end of the Great Northern War, or 1720 for most of the powers involved. With that in mind then, in this episode we continue the incredible tale of diplomacy and the trails of diplomacy that snaked all over the continent and which were born largely out of the mind and ambitions of the aforementioned Goertz. It's a tale as winding and complex as it is fascinating, so without any further ado, let's see how Goertz's eventful career progressed and how the Great Northern War effectively concluded. A huge thanks to all of you for supporting this show, especially at times like these. I really do appreciate it. It's meant so much to me to have you guys here, and the fact that you're getting this series at the same time means I don't feel so bad for taking your money in these difficult COVID-related times. I hope you're all staying safe and that you're able to take about half an hour or so out of your busy lives to just relax and think of how thankful you are that you weren't born during this era 300 years ago. Okay, enough rambling. Let's get into it. I'll now take you to autumn 1716. By the time Tsar Peter called off the invasion of Sweden in late September 1716, the kingdom of Charles XII appeared to be facing into a crisis. After over 15 years of war, the inhabitants of Sweden were demoralized, defeated, and very, very depleted. War had brought no triumphs once Poltava had so reversed the balance of power in northeast Europe. From 1709, the news seemed to grow worse and worse on a daily basis. In Charles's defiant mind, such developments were the mere temporary consequences of a flagging war effort, but no losses were too great to be reversed. All it would take was a grand victory, a strategic coup, or some skillful negotiation, and Sweden would be back on top. For these reasons, Charles elected never to see his enemies' gains as permanent, to think of making a compromise peace, or to slacken in the realm of diplomacy. We have seen in the past just how stubborn, to the point of blindness, King Charles XII of Sweden seemed to be. By 1716, these traits of his character had become arguably even more pronounced, but his efforts in the realm of diplomacy, under the leadership of Baron Georg Heinrich von Goertz since February 1716, also deserve analysis. Tsar Peter's stated belief that Charles would never give up until Sweden lay in ruins was perhaps true when we consider just how tenaciously this previously unknown German diplomat, that being Goertz, was permitted to pursue diplomatic options, with results that came within a few signatures of handing a lot of the initiative back to Sweden. As the trend had by this point showed, one such signature that reportedly held Goertz back was that of his master and friend, the King of Sweden, Charles XII. But Gerts would not let the unwillingness of his king to compromise with his enemies take away from his own impressive vision. When Gerts surveyed Sweden's strategic situation in 1716, he appreciated that Sweden couldn't possibly defeat the six powers that were set against her. Russia, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, Prussia, Hanover, Britain, and even Denmark all wanted a piece of Sweden's pie, but Gerts could discern that the weakness of the Northern anti-Swedish alliance was its very size. The number of League members all held their own distinct prejudices and concerns, based on reasons of geography, of history, or blind ambition. Gerts was determined to exploit these, and like a true diplomatic artist, engineer the system towards viewing Sweden as the centre of negotiation, around which the League members would be forced to revolve. To achieve this end, he believed that the best policy open to Charles would be a negotiated peace with the Tsar. If Russia was removed from the equation, Sweden would be free to combat the lesser other members of the alliance. Gerts believed that each of the remaining powers all had their price, and Hanover in particular harboured barely veiled hostile opinions regarding Russia's continued rise. By removing Russia, the offensive heart of the League would be removed, and if attacked, Gerts believed that rather than stand alone, each of the members would be open to settlement, a settlement which could well be geared towards combating Russia. Gerts's plan to make peace with Russia involved the ceding of all the Baltic provinces, which many Swedes would have found unpalatable considering the importance of those Baltic ports. But Gerts seemed to believe that by sacrificing these Baltic gains, the German possessions could be reconquered and Sweden's North German position re-established. Gerts might sound like he had it all together, but he did have a fair number of critics. They were already legion in Sweden by this point, and they accused him of wanting to take back Sweden's German colonies purely because of his old ties to his old master, and his old master was the Duke of Holstein. Holstein being that state in Germany just below the border with Denmark. The opposition which grew against Gerts in Sweden was sourced from his bypassing of the traditional bonds of Swedish government. And by that I mean Gerts answered to no one save King Charles himself, and Stockholm's aristocracy were left out in the cold as this newly installed, unaccountable German dictated Sweden's future to them and to the rest of Europe. Furthermore, with Charles's succession in a state of flux, having never married, the Swedish crown was destined to fall into two camps. Either to King Charles's sister Ulrika, who was married to the Duke of Hesse, or to Charles's cousin, the Duke of Holstein, who Gerts had once served. Ulrika's Hessian party were thus hostile to Gerts, since they believed everything that Gerts did was not for the good of Sweden, but for the good of Gerts's original patron, the Duke of Holstein, and of course to Sweden's detriment. This Hessian party, led by the King of Sweden's sister, Ulrika, therefore declared themselves unwilling to obey Gerts's line of policy, and they made a great fuss in Stockholm, spreading untoward rumours about Gerts's behaviour and corruption, which, as it happened, were baseless for once. For all of Gerts's flaws, now he was arrogant, ruthless, and overbearing at times, Sweden needed someone like this German diplomat, skilled and loyal above all to Charles, and who was capable of streamlining the entire diplomatic process where the officials in Stockholm would have presented a great set of stumbling blocks. Gerts also felt that he understood German policies better than those in Stockholm, and in this he was probably correct. He appreciated the anxiety which gripped each of the anti-Swedish members. They were fearful of Tsar Peter, and they were eager to get some prizes before the opportunity for doing so was lost. Playing to these concerns, among others, required a great depth of knowledge about his adversaries, and Gerts had this in spades. The most useful piece of intel that Gerts had was that George I of Britain and Hanover was deeply suspicious and resentful of the Russian Tsar. So, Gerts made the decision to meet both of these figures. In June 1716, while Tsar Peter had been in Holland, Gerts had met the Tsar. Peter knew of Gertz from his service in Holstein, and he was willing to talk around a range of issues with him. Considering that Gertz went into the meeting knowing full well that Charles would never agree to the concessions necessary, the process that Gertz and the Tsar made in these talks was pretty remarkable. Peter and Gertz formulated a kind of new world order, where Russia and Sweden would hold the balance of power, to be guaranteed by France, and Sweden would be free to take what she wanted from the remaining League powers, above all Denmark and Hanover. The common theme throughout the talks was that Denmark would be forced to pay for whatever peace was decided, and Peter showed himself surprisingly willing to abandon the Danes to their fate if the price was right. Perhaps by this point, the Tsar already suspected and resented the Danish tendency to postulate and delay in matters of joint strategy. By the summer of 1716, the Tsar was already anxious and frustrated by the low rate of mobilisation which the Allies had shown, and the tardiness of the Danish fleet irritated him above all. If Sweden would cede the Baltic provinces, she could keep Finland and gain compensation from the seizure of any other of her old German lands. This was Peter's proposal, and it was accompanied by the first mention of a peace conference to take place in the Åland Islands in the Gulf of Bothnia. The Åland Islands were especially significant. Not only were these islands in Peter's favourite sea, the Baltic, but the islands were far harder for spies to penetrate, and they were thus believed to be safer to have as a place for negotiations. Gertz made great pains to have the details of his negotiations with Peter leaked to the Hanoverians, and he ensured that George would be among those in the know of how far Peter had been willing to go to make peace. Hanover's name was notably on the list of those that the Tsar was willing to abandon to the Swedes in return for a peace which favoured St. Petersburg, and this can only have confirmed George's original suspicions of the Tsar, which had never been favourable. Frederick IV of Denmark was also alarmed, as his name had been on the list too. Denmark had essentially been labelled as the fall guy of this anti-Swedish league, with Peter rightly suspecting himself that Sweden would seek compensation from their old enemy in Norway and in Germany when push came to shove. Anxious not to be pushed or shoved into a corner, Danish and Hanoverian agents began to eagerly meet with allies of Gertz in a bid to outmaneuver Russia. In return for a peace, they offered far more favourable terms than Peter had, and with this, Gertz knew he was making progress. For the first time in a long time, the initiative, in the diplomatic sphere at least, was with Sweden. Now, in one of our first When Diplomacy Fails Thinks episodes, we looked at the tenuous and fraught relationship between Tsar Peter and his son Alexis. By 1717, in line with that episode's story, all of the talk of Europe at the time was of the Tsar's impetuous heir and his escapades across the continent, which had also drawn in the Habsburgs and massively complicated matters. Peter couldn't focus on affairs with Sweden so long as his son remained such an embarrassment and the talk of European courts. Thus, in Gertz's mind, 1717 was to be something of a slow year for northeastern diplomacy. I'm not planning on covering that affair between the Tsar and his son Alexis, so do listen to that episode if you want more context, but in short, the whole thing was messy and distracted the Tsar from paying attention to the proper business of the Swedish war. It also meant that Gertz essentially waited for the affair with the Tsar's son to pass over. So, it's worth considering what other business and diplomacy was conducted in 1717, since the Tsar was otherwise preoccupied. Until that conference on the Åland Islands could take place in May 1718, much of the diplomatic angling which took place across the continent in the interim revolved around the gradual spilling over of the Western agreements of Europe into the Northeastern. And what I mean by that is, upon the ending of the War of the Spanish Succession, the creation of a new regency in France and the ascension to the throne of Spain of Philip V, a Bourbon king, the balance in Europe seemed to shift. Britain abandoned its recent policy course of opposition to France and allied itself with the Dutch, the Holy Roman Emperor, and the burgeoning French regency of Louis XV to check the ambitions of Philip V's regime in Spain. The powers and scope of this quadruple alliance, as it would be called, between the French, the British, the Dutch, and the Holy Roman Emperor, would result in a war with Philip V of Spain in early 1718, called the War of the Quadruple Alliance. This war ended in 1720. The nature of European wars and diplomacy, and the extent to which they overlapped, is, obviously, really fascinating. Not least because the different theatres and the potential for cooperation in each theatre profoundly frightened the British, irritated the Dutch, and confounded the Austrians. Philip V of Spain would not give up his pretensions on the French throne, and he continued to claim succession to it in the event of the child, Louis XV's, death. This was of course unacceptable to the French, who very much planned on having Louis XV succeed as king once he came of age, and it was also unacceptable to the regent regime that was in place there, keeping the seat of Louis XV faithfully warm until he came of age. It was also unacceptable to those that wanted to prevent the union of France and Spain, which was pretty much everyone. And don't forget, preventing this union had been one of the major causes of the War of the Spanish Succession, rather than Louis XIV's underlying ambitions for the Spanish crown per se. On top of this, Spain had rebuilt its Mediterranean fleet by 1716 and invaded Sicily in the following year, just as Austria was waging a short war against the Ottomans and was a bit distracted. Because Vienna was distracted by its Ottoman concerns, Spain was able to take Sicily back from the Habsburgs by November of 1717, and this proved to be the final straw for Western Europe. In a bid to check the ambitions and powers of Philip V of Spain, Britain joined with the Dutch, the regent regime in France, and the assailed Habsburgs in making war on Spain. Another reason for the War of the Quadruple Alliance, which may be seen as a legacy of Louis XIV's policies, as much as Philip V's, was that George I of Britain Hanover, and many of his advisors, were concerned that Philip V of Spain and Tsar Peter were on the verge of an agreement that would see Russia, Spain, the Ottomans, and Savoy formulate a defensive alliance in addition to the one already formed in opposition to Sweden. Not only would this massively complicate matters, it would also place the British naval position in grave danger. With the Russians expanding their fleet in the Baltic and Spain following suit in the Mediterranean, Britain couldn't keep pace with both in the event of a war. Split in both theatres, London's economic interests in both spheres would be placed in severe jeopardy, and disaster would be the result. Launching a war with Spain in early 1718, while Russia continued to negotiate, thus solved one of these problems because it neutered Spain before Madrid and Moscow could formulate any kind of binding arrangement. In the event, the power of Spain proved largely illusory, and Tsar Peter was no closer to making a common agreement with Philip V than Charles XII was to ceding Livonia. But George I and his anxious ministers couldn't know this for sure, and so they felt compelled to stamp out one of these threats before it became too late to do so. With war waging in the Mediterranean until 1720, the Western Allies, including Britain Hanover, were in a disadvantaged position to bring about any kind of enforced peace in the Baltic, and Britain's Baltic fleet actually had to be sent to the Mediterranean to fight the Spanish, which of course left the Danes and some Dutch vessels mostly alone against whatever Peter decided to do there. The Elector King George I's attitude towards Peter is thus understandable when considered in the context of the wider continental concerns that plagued Britain by 1717. But London believed at the same time it had something of a diplomatic ace up its sleeve in the course of these negotiations. Even while the Tsar couldn't be persuaded to meet with the Swedes and put everyone out of their misery until May 1718, negotiations up to that point had centred on the question, could Britain and a collection of Western allies manage to detach Russia's greatest ally, King Augustus of Poland, from his side? The machinations of London from mid-1716 onwards suggested that there was a prevailing belief in European circles that not only was the Commonwealth detachable from the Russian orbit, but that there were elements within Poland that would have jumped at the chance to join an anti-Russian league with Britain at its head. Imagine that. We're about to start talking about Poland in Poland Is Not Yet Lost, just in case you forgot what this series was all about. But yes, as affairs progressed through 1716, the incredible possibility came to King Augustus. Could he make use of foreign help to wrest control of his country back from the Russians? Not only that, but would he bring himself to turn on his most important and powerful patron if the price was right? Such questions were high in the mind of the Holy Roman Emperor as much as the King and Elector, George I, both of whom had tired of the Tsar's expanding powers and wished, through this potential diplomatic coup, to cripple one of Russia's major policy principles. If the Commonwealth could be brought to the side of the British, Dutch, French and Habsburgs with some certainty, then Western Europe would be secured against Russian encroachments, and Moscow would be constantly unsure of its own security in the East. The plan was thus launched to detach Peter's greatest friend, Augustus, from his side. Gdansk was the Commonwealth's only significant Baltic port, and it was also a major port of call for several naval powers, including Britain. And it was in Gdansk that negotiations between the Western Allies were developed to include a demand for the evacuation of Poland by Russian troops. A further concern was the Duchy of Mecklenburg, where the Duke had married one of Peter's nieces and in return had taken the Russian host into quarters. This arrangement proved a boon for both parties. The Duke was able to use the 30,000 Russians to crush any noble opposition to his absolutist regime, and the Russians were able to gain free provisions and quarters for the foreseeable future. Not to mention that it was strategically very valuable for the Tsar to be able to quarter 30,000 soldiers in Germany rather than have to march them all the way from Russia any time they were needed. This way, the power of Russia would be visible, but almost because it was so visible, it started to make everyone nervous. The problem in the mind of Britain and the Holy Roman Emperor was that the Holy Roman Empire's Aulic Council, which was an administrative and legal body charged with solving the disputes of varied princes and potentates, had already ruled in favour of the nobility of Mecklenburg in their struggle with their overbearing duke, Karl Leopold. In other words, the Holy Roman Empire itself was trying to tell this overbearing duke, who was now connected to the Tsar by marriage, that he should stop oppressing his own people and let his nobles have a bit more say in how Mecklenburg was run. But then Russian troops arrived, stormed into Mecklenburg and effectively overturned the Holy Roman Emperor's ruling through the use of force. Tsar Peter, by doing this, could be accused of actively interfering with imperial matters, and neither the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles VI, nor his technical subject, George I, could allow this insult to imperial German sovereignty to stand. Tsar Peter's blatant disregard for the Empire's rulings may have been out of ignorance more than malice, but it proved an effective incident to beat the Russians with, and it compelled the Emperor to seek ways of gaining satisfaction. For some time, the option of Poland had been suggested, but only when the Russian activities in Mecklenburg had so rankled European opinion did the daring interference in Russia's Polish garden seem to be justified. Despite the impressions I may have given you up to this point, and despite some things I may have said, considering Poland as a de facto puppet of Russia wouldn't be quite correct. Augustus's position was far from unassailable, and he undoubtedly relied upon the Tsar for much of his military support, but the Russians were not as unpopular or totally in control across the Commonwealth as the initial report of the situation might suggest. While Peter's policy could accurately be said to guide and shape Augustus's policy, this was largely because both Augustus and Peter had formed a strong relationship over the last decade and a half, and because both men saw eye to eye on the Swedish problem. It wasn't, in other words, a relationship formed because Augustus was inherently fearful of Moscow's power. Don't forget, the war against Sweden had been launched in the first place because of collusion between these two men, back when Augustus was the stronger power in the equation. So it stands to reason that after enduring all the ups and downs, the highs and lows, the terrible defeats, when it seemed as though Sweden was completely invulnerable, that now that they were enjoying some success, the two men should be closer than ever. If there hadn't been that baseline of friendship between the King of Poland and the Tsar, then Western diplomats probably would have met with more success, and Augustus would never have displayed the surprising, for his character at least, loyalty and resilience towards the Tsar which he demonstrated, although for a brief period between 1717 to 19. The turning point for the King of Poland, and the moment when he began to cultivate plans for a different diplomatic arrangement in Europe than he had hitherto considered, arrived in the form of Eugene of Savoy and his stunning victory against the Ottomans at Belgrade in August 1717. When this battle was recorded across Europe, the triumph of the Habsburgs over the Turks seemed to be assured, and Habsburg military prestige was at an all-time high. In Augustus's mind, an alliance with the Holy Roman Emperor now seemed to offer definite advantages, and through the Emperor, further allies could be accrued across Germany, which might prove as valuable, if not more so, than the alliance with Russia to the east. To Augustus's apparent defection from his singular Russian alliance, we must also add that the King of Poland had become somewhat miffed by Peter's behaviour over the previous years. A relationship which started out imbalanced, that is, in Poland's favour, had swung dramatically the other way. So even while Augustus was perhaps a bit more loyal than we might expect, by the late 17-teens, if that makes sense, the scales were beginning to fall from his eyes. It would have been relatively easy, for example, for an objective Commonwealth official to draw up a list of grievances committed by the Russians over the previous years, and beginning after Poltava in 1709. The issue was, would Augustus listen to these grievances, or would he not? Either way, since that date, while the Tsar's friendship had become increasingly important, the Tsar's policies had also become increasingly uncompromising, and in the minds of many Commonwealth nobles, overbearing. Russian forces had destroyed vast swathes of Commonwealth territory as they retreated from the King of Sweden in 1708, and Peter's original pledge to offer compensation for this offence never bore fruit. Furthermore, Russia was still occupying the right bank of the Ukraine, long considered Polish land, and everywhere the Tsar's armies resided, they evoked strong protests and much annoyance. The Tsar had become too big for his boots, a portion of the Commonwealth's nobility claimed, and only through strategic agreement with some of Peter's rivals could this Polish Republic leverage a better deal from Russia. This better deal could be offered by the Western Allies, led above all by Britain. Since Britain and Hanover were united under the Elector King, George, the position of Hanover in the anti-Swedish League seems especially complex. Did George of Britain-Hanover wish to defeat Sweden on the battlefield, or did he want to defeat Russia through some other means? It is also worth considering that Augustus was the absolutist elector of Saxony, and that in this capacity he declared his readiness to enter into an alliance with his fellow elector George of Hanover and the Holy Roman Emperor. Poland-Lithuania, much like it had been at the beginning of the Great Northern War, was technically excluded from this arrangement, but mirroring again the terms of that conflict, it was highly unlikely that the Commonwealth would stay removed from Augustus's intrigues for long. Augustus knew what he was doing, or at least he pretended to know what he was doing. He could send a strong message to the Tsar about his own independence of action by acting in his capacity as elector to get the alliance he wanted with the Tsar's nominal rivals. The message was received clearly in Moscow to Peter's intense irritation. If the Commonwealth's varied divisions were resolved, there seemed good reason to suppose the Republic would follow its king into an accord with the Emperor and the Elector of Hanover. Tsar Peter could not allow this to happen, but he was hamstrung by events in Sweden while he also awaited everything to blow over with his own son. Perhaps by 1717, the Tsar was beginning to discover the penalties of overstretching one's attentions. With his fingers in more pies than ever before, Peter was simply unable to give due attention to every sphere. And it was thus fortunate for him that Gertz's vaunted negotiations at the Åland Islands did not take place in 1717, since it's unlikely that the Tsar, distracted as he was by Augustus's suggestive policies in that year, would have felt confident enough in his position to actually go there and negotiate. The silent Sejm of spring 1717 features into this kaleidoscope of intrigue, but the eventful years of 1716 to 18 are simply too dense to cover it in detail in this episode. Next time Augustus's position in the Commonwealth, and the silent same which greatly shaped his status as king, will be examined, but it is worth considering now the context in which Augustus operated. Above all, the problem Augustus faced when attempting to formulate anything in the Commonwealth was the delays and complications posed by the fractured parliamentary system there, where a single objective voice, the Liberum Veto, was enough to bin entire proposals, and where the Russian presence loomed large in the minds of the Commonwealth's officials. This explains Augustus's decision to act in his capacity as Elector of Saxony rather than King of Poland when declaring his wish to join with his Hanoverian colleagues and the Habsburg Emperor. But within the Commonwealth, the nobility there had been greatly encouraged, perhaps even emboldened, by affairs elsewhere. Some nobles in the Commonwealth began to intimidate the Tsar's Russian delegate to the Polish Sejm in late 1717, in the aftermath of the Habsburg victory at Belgrade, and in the midst of news of Augustus's intentions, rumoured or not, to ally with the Habsburgs. The Commonwealth nobles who had sought to rid themselves of the Russian presence intimated to that same Russian delegate that if the Tsar would not remove his forces from the Commonwealth and cease in his blockade of Gdansk, then they would seek to secure their republic's interests through alternative means. What alternative means were referred to likely involved some kind of accord against the Tsar, involving the recent partners Augustus had made in his capacity as Elector of Saxony. The Commonwealth nobles that pursued such a daring and defiant policy evidently believed that it was only a matter of time before King Augustus's Saxon and Polish foreign policy lines overlapped, as they had done in the past. Yet, as Augustus himself well appreciated, the dream which some nobles in the Commonwealth may have had of turning on Russia was not so simple. That these Polish dramas were all overlapping with the negotiations of Gertz adds to the fascinating story of the era, which is rarely if ever told. While 1717 was a relatively quiet year in Gertz's career, as we have seen, as Charles XII's agent, he didn't cease during that year to try and seek some advantage for his sovereign, even if the direct negotiations with Russia on the Åland Islands were delayed. What Gertz proposed to do was effectively hold out a separate peace with Sweden as a kind of carrot for the other powers of the anti-Swedish League to chase. Making much of his intentions to treat separately with the Commonwealth, Gertz intended to sow further discord between Augustus and Peter by attempting to put some steel into the Poles and make them question their own alliance with Russia. The best way to achieve this discord was to highlight the sensitive issue of Gdansk, emphasize the burden posed by the quartering of vast amounts of Russian troops, and to negotiate separately with the different members of the anti-Swedish League. Appreciating that George of Britain Hanover had overlapping concerns in the Baltic and Mediterranean theatres, Gertz hoped to gain some diplomatic credit from ensuring that Augustus, as Elector of Saxony, tied himself closer to Peter's Hanoverian rival. Although technically allies, Hanover and Russia couldn't see eye to eye as long as Peter continued to garrison such large bodies of Russian troops on German soil. The overbearing means by which Peter quartered these troops, and the impact these troops had on the Duke of Mecklenburg, as well as the Holy Roman Emperor's authority, all painted a negative picture. Gertz could aggravate the tensions between Hanover and Russia by making suggestive diplomatic advances towards the Western powers, indicating, so it seemed to Peter, Sweden's willingness to make a separate peace with Russia's allies, which would leave Russia alone to face Sweden and perhaps the wrath of a new League of Western powers. So it was that the Western, Northeastern, and even Eastern Ottoman front played a role in the interconnected diplomacy of the twilight phase of the Great Northern War. With Sweden led by the clever and skilled Gertz, Augustus had been induced to seek further agreements with his electoral colleague in Hanover, and George of Hanover's British possession, as much as Augustus's Polish throne, seemed destined to overlap with disastrous consequences for Tsar Peter when it was learned in November 1717 that London had proposed an alliance not merely with Augustus of Saxony, but with the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth itself. reading between the lines, one could fairly easily see that this alliance was hostile to Russian interests. Yet Hanover remained a member of the anti-Swedish League and a nominal ally of Russia nonetheless. By May 1718, mere days before the Tsar's agents were set to meet with their Swedish counterparts at the Åland Islands, Peter was accusing Augustus, his firm and sovereign friend, of scheming with the British behind his back. Augustus was both encouraged and deeply concerned at the pace of developments in the Commonwealth since the silent same of February 1717. Far from a docile and compliant nation under the Russian thumb, 1717 seemed to be the year of defiance for the Commonwealth. Such defiance spilled into the Russo-Polish negotiations for the next 2 years, with the order of the day being the evacuation of Russian troops from the Commonwealth and the immediate cessation of Russian interference with either the affairs of Poland or the Holy Roman Empire. Next time, as the conference with the Swedes was begun at the Åland Islands in May 1718, we'll see how the interconnected diplomacy of the era continued to blend different theatres of Europe together. The result being that by the time Gertz sat with his Russian counterparts, he was keenly aware of what his handiwork had achieved. Russia was now under pressure from a league of allies which were formulating demands for the Tsar to obey. This new league had been compelled to act by the fear that Sweden and Russia were close to a personal accord, which would have left the rest of the continent in awe of a new age of Russo-Swedish cooperation. And Gertz's breathtaking vision had ensured that even while such developments contradicted one another, nobody could be sure, thanks to the tangled web that he had weaved, which eventuality would be reached first. It was, in many respects, a scramble for gains and security, and many believed or suspected or feared that tradition and friendship would not be allowed to stand in the way. And this, my dear history friends and patrons, is only just one aspect of the story of that German diplomat, Gertz. He had achieved the impossible, but he was only, just, getting started. Where would Gertz go next? I hope you'll join me next time to find out, but in the meantime, you have been a wonderful patron, I have been Zach Twomley, and this has been Poland Is Not Yet Lost. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Hope you take care of yourselves. I hope you've enjoyed this episode here, and I'll be seeing all of you in 2 weeks' time. But realistically, soon.